What do you think is the biggest mistake some of these companies make as startups?
The biggest mistake is scaling revenue too early and too fast, you know, because they're confused on what product market fit is. They kind of like go out, they find 3, 4, 5 customers, beta customers, let's call them, and the product works for them. And they're like, sweet, let's scale. And the venture capitalist gives them $5-10 million and they hire 20 salespeople the next month.
And now the man you've been waiting for, John, the sales machine, Rankin!
Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is a legend in the tech space. He started his career as a technology consultant with Accenture, and went on to become the driving force of growing HubSpot's sales division, where he increased sales revenue, get this, by 6,000% and expanded the team from 1 to 450 employees as the founding CRO. These results placed HubSpot number 33 on the 2011 Inc. 500 fastest growing companies list. He was ranked number 19 in Forbes' top 30 social sellers in the world and awarded the 2010 Salesperson of the Year at the MIT Sales Conference. He has led hundreds of his employees to the acquisition and retention of HubSpot's first 10,000 customers across 60 countries. He's currently a senior lecturer at Harvard Business School and the co-founder of Stage 2 Capital, which invests in early stage B2B software companies. He is the author of the best-selling The Sales Acceleration Formula. Please welcome Mark Roberge.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Wow.
I really wanted to get you on the show because, you know, I've been doing direct sales for 30 years, building and scaling sales teams. And in 2018, I had the first iteration of the Sales Machine software, which is a sales performance management system. And so I was flying to LA to present it in front of a crowd of like 800 people. And I was posting on Facebook, as I was reading your book, I was so inspired how you guys grew that to $100 billion company. And I was just completely blown away, especially because of the methodology you use. Because, you know, a lot of marketers talk about how to sell without selling, right? And become the nectar. And HubSpot did that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, thank you. I remember your post. And yeah, I mean, that's everyone that's what was the key thing to the success. And that was definitely one of the biggest things was like, it wasn't like we invented a company, we invented a movement. You know what I mean? Like this, we invented a term called inbound marketing. And we were also fortunate, this isn't always an important ingredient of company success, nor is it always an option, but we got to eat our own cooking. I would say the first like 3 or 4 years of customer acquisition all originated from inbound marketing. You know, like our CEO Halligan told our CMO, Mike Volpe, I don't want to do trade shows. I don't want to do cold calls. I don't want to do ads. I don't want, you know, I want to write blogs so that people find us. And that's how we're going to do our sales and marketing. So it was kind of like the opposite of a perfect storm, a perfect opportunity, I suppose.
You know, Chet Holmes wrote a book a long time ago. And my very first episode of The Sales Machine was a tribute to him. It was called The Ultimate Sales Machine. And he used education-based marketing to really scale companies up. And he had passed away. I'd looked for him to mentor me, and I found out that he had already passed. So when I decided to do this podcast, I did the first episode's a tribute to him.
So cool. And his writings is a way your mentorship, his legacy. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And HubSpot used that methodology, education-based marketing, to disrupt the market. I mean, Salesforce was already a monster, right?
Yeah, and they had their own movement. You know, they were, if you look at the early, you know, marketing of SaaS, of Salesforce, it was a big circle with the word software with a red X through it. That was their movement.
Yeah.
That's how they, you know, they were one of the first, they were kind of like the cloud provider. And yeah, we, you know, we actually didn't go head to head with them, believe it or not, in the beginning. They, when we entered the market in around 06, we were a marketing software company, SaaS, you know, and they were pretty much just CRM. I think that's the only cloud they had at the time. So we weren't competitive. In fact, a couple of years later, we did our Series D investment led by Sequoia. And the participants in that round were Google Ventures and Salesforce Ventures. They actually invested in HubSpot. Crazy.
Crazy.
We were getting almost 10% of our customers through them as a partner. But ultimately, we all knew, like, if we continue to grow and they continue to expand, we would overlap.
Yeah.
And that just happens. You know?
Well, then they became a marketplace for a bunch of apps. I remember seeing.
Yeah, they entered the marketing cloud and we entered the sales CRM sector. And, you know, I think we've continued to find their segment. I haven't been like a day-to-day operator in the company for almost a decade, you know, since the IPO. I'm still an advisor, so I don't know all the ins and outs these days, but I'm sure there's more overlap. And they tried to buy us a couple times. I wanted to sell. I'd never made any money before. You know, I had two young kids and maybe a couple of $1,000 in my bank account. And I think the first time around they offered 400 mil and I was like, yes, this is great.
Let's do this.
I was going to be able to not work for a couple of years. And but Brian and Dharmesh had made money before. So they wanted to build a legacy company that outlived them. And then we got an offer a couple of years later for $1 billion and they still said no. And yeah, and they did it so far. And it, you know, it was worth it, but it was, you know, during it was really stressful, but looking back, it was quite a life experience.
How did you get involved? I mean, I know you went to MIT and then you started working for Accenture, and a lot of my developers in the Philippines, they previously were at Accenture.
Yeah, just too quickly. I mean, I was an engineer undergrad and I went to Accenture after undergrad. And then, I don't know, I was writing code and then, this was like the late 90s. The startup boom hadn't happened yet. And for a lot of people listening, they probably weren't working yet in the 1990s, you know? And it's funny to think that like startups weren't really a thing back then. Like I didn't have a single class. I didn't have a single peer in college that was like, oh, I'm going to do a startup. Like that was like a thing for like bored rich people. But then like the late 90s happened, venture capital like 100x'd. Like almost overnight, we had all this create, and all of a sudden it's like startups. And I loved it. I was sitting there at Accenture about to become like this, like, you know, big company specialist. And I don't, you know, it just wasn't for me. It's a great career. It's awesome. I'm the unbelievable company. But I just like, and I got staffed at a startup through Accenture and I never looked back. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And I quit, you know, 6 months later, and a couple of the Accenture partners had started like a mobile startup. I was in New York at the time and I went there and I loved it. You know, we scaled it up to like 100 people and then the dot-com bust happened and we laid everybody off, you know, and I was like kind of got to stay there because I owned a couple accounts and I knew it wasn't going to be anything. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to have to go do something else. And I was like, should I go try to find the next Google or should I go to business school? I was like 26 at the time. I was like, well, you know, you only kind of have one window in your life where you really go to business school. So, you know, let me go. I got in at MIT. I went there and I just engrossed myself in the startup ecosystem. I started a bit, you know, so I worked on a bunch of startups. I started up a business in social media at the time. And I was in a class on starting companies. I happened to sit next to Dharmesh Shah, who was the co-founder of HubSpot. And it was a class of like 50 students and we all had to come up with a business idea to get into the class. And then we all voted and 10 people in the class got to be CEOs of their company and everybody else had to join a company, you know, as part of the class. And my idea got picked and Dharmesh's idea got picked. His idea was HubSpot. Crazy, right? I remember him standing in front of the class presenting it, same logo as it is today. Crazy. And we became friends and we would talk, you know, go to lunch every like couple weeks. And when I told him I was actually going to do my company, he invested. He had made some money before school. So he was an angel investor and we kept talking. And then, he had struck a deal that like, hey, you're going to probably need some money if you're going to do this after school. Why don't you help me with HubSpot every Thursday? And so that's how I got involved. I just needed money. I was doing my startup. I had two little babies and I helped him. And then a few months into that journey, every Thursday I was still over there, he's like, hey, I got someone to run HubSpot because I promised my wife I'd never run a company again. He didn't really like to run the businesses, you know? And he said, I got this guy, Brian Halligan. So I met Brian and Brian kind of met me, but interviewed me. And he's like, cool. I'm glad you're here every Thursday. Like, but I don't need you to do strategy. I just want you to do sales. Like we have a product now. So it was just Brian and Darmesh and like, you know, a couple people like freelancers like me. And that's how I got into sales. And, you know, we just, you know, brought in a couple dozen of the first customers. And then at some point it was crazy because my company, I wasn't going to be able to get my Series A. I didn't execute well enough. It wasn't the right time in the market, whatever. And I had, you know, a little baby and pregnant wife at the time. And I was going to have to go to a big company. I had $100,000 loans from MIT, $2,000 in the bank account. You know, you can picture it's pretty stressful. And fortunately, Brian, he was like, hey, you should quit your startup and come join us. And he didn't know that I was about to have to like, you know, shut it down. And he brought me to a Red Sox game and asked me to do, he's like, we're about to raise a Series A and you should come be the first salesperson and build out the sales org. So I literally thought I was just going to go somewhere for a couple months and collect a real paycheck. And then 9 years later, we were ringing the bell on the New York Stock Exchange. So it was kind of a serendipitous moment, you know?
Yeah, man. Congratulations. It's a great journey. And, you know, I remember I was flying to LA to launch my software and, you know, I had these grandeur visions and I had a chief technology officer who was going to check out the first iteration of the sales machine. And she also went to MIT. Her name was Paru Madan. And she said, you know what?
Ramadan. She must have been in one of the engineering. Was she in like an engineering school? Or
yeah. Yeah. And anyway, she said, you know, as long as you show me that you can go on stage and you can sell this thing and I check out the technology and it can scale, then I'll join the team. So anyway, I went in front of like 800 people on stage and I just, you know, talked about how we have improved so many different companies in so many different industries, their sales performance using the sales machine. The same psychology, the same methodology, but now we have it in technology. Anyway, I landed 28 clients from the stage. At like $5,000 a pop, just to try it out.
Sick.
And then when I came down, she goes, all right, check that box. No problem. You got this. But the technology has to be scalable. So when she checked it out, it was built on old code. It was fabricated without the proper infrastructure. And she goes, well, it's not a no, but you have to agree that you'll build it all over. Yeah. And I'm like, what? That just cost me $250,000.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, no. So anyway, it's been years, but I stayed inspired based on.
That's common, though, man. That's common, though. Like, I think we rebuilt HubSpot like two or three times. Like, not rebuilt it, but like, you have to re-architect a lot. You know, that first thing you do, you don't know what you're building, so you got to pivot left and right, and you end up with spaghetti code. And then once you got it, you know, a lot of times you have to like re-architect it almost from the ground up now that you know what you got. So I don't know. Like, at least back then. These days you can modularize it a little bit more, but like,
yeah, that's what we're doing. Actually, we just integrated microservices. Well, it's not an integration.
Yeah, go.
There's like five modules. There's a sales CRM. There's a marketing suite. There's achievement through accountability. That's where there's a patent pending on the software, and then retention and training.
Beautiful.
It's taken a while. It's been a great journey, and I've, you know, helped a lot of people along the way. So I'm 100% am grateful that I still did it, right? Because most people would just give up or find a way to raise money. I wasn't smart enough to raise money.
I don't know if there's a correlation to smarts raising money. I like venture capital is like the front page news stuff, but like most wealth is generated in non-venture backed startup. So I think you might have like done better, maybe.
Yeah, I could have done better. Definitely.
No, I don't know. I think you did better without raising, honestly. People fall in love with the allure of venture capital, but it's not for every startup, and it has some negative connotations to it. Hey, I'm a venture capitalist, so hopefully I'm speaking the truth.
Yeah, that's gonna be my next question. You're the co-founder of Stage 2 Capital. What are the common traits of startups that tell you they will be successful?
First off, let me just tell you about Stage 2, because you have to understand the background to understand my answer. And by the way, I never like set out to be a venture capitalist. Like ever since the IPO, I've been a little, is the right word, like Buddhist in my career. You know, it's just kind of like looking back after the IPO, I'm like, holy cow, like everything I did from like going to sales, joining HubSpot, writing a book, I didn't pursue any of that. All like the big moves that, all the moves that led to great things in my career were not things that I applied for, pursued. They were things that just presented themselves. And it's like, it's not like you can just sit around. If you're a younger professional, you can't just sit around and wait for stuff to happen. But it's more like have your plan, but make sure that you at least consider alternative opportunities that present themselves that weren't in your plan, because they may lead to the best things. And so I was in a fortunate situation from like a success and resume and financial perspective, you know, like yourself at that time, to just, you know, not have to be as proactive in driving my career. And Harvard approached me. I didn't apply to Harvard to be a faculty member. They approached me because they had a need for a sales curriculum. And all I had was like, I knew how much I wanted to spend working, and I knew that I wanted to spend that time, probably like yourself, providing value to the startup ecosystem through the lens of sales and go-to-market. And Harvard Business School provided an amazing platform to do that, and I've loved it. And then years later, this really great venture capitalist at Bessemer, one of the best firms in the world, Jay Poe, he approached me about building the first venture capital firm that was exclusively run and backed by the most successful sales and marketing leaders in tech. Like the head of sales at Salesforce and, you know, SAP and Zoom and Atlassian and Snowflake and all these great companies. And I was like, cool, that would be amazing. Like the ecosystem doesn't have that. And that's what we went out, and people loved it. And today we have 3 funds, 40 companies, 500 sales and marketing leaders from all those companies that have written us substantial checks. And we use that capital to back startups. And we provide them obviously with sales and marketing advice. We leverage that whole network. You're selling into friggin' hospitals. Great. I got the person that like knows how to do that. You know what I mean? So you have to understand that background and know what we look for, because every VC has a different model. That's what, as an entrepreneur, you have to like know that. Like, don't be offended if a VC says we're not a fit for you. It doesn't mean your idea is not good. Like, as a venture capitalist, we had to raise money from other people. And when we did that, we had to explain to them what we were going to do. And I told our investors that we were going to invest in companies when they're around $1 million in revenue that are in B2B software, and we're going to help them build their first sales team. So if you have this idea for like, a woman's blouse, I'm not going to invest. It's no offense to you. I just can't. That's not our thing. If you have a business that's like 100,000 in revenue or 100 million in revenue, I can't invest. That's not our model, right? So that first off, you have to understand, a lot of entrepreneurs don't get that you got to almost do, like we learn in sales, to do discovery with your own investor to find out what their model is, to see if there's a fit. And so that's where we invest. And we invest there because we feel like there's probably enough customer traction to assess product market fit. Like to your point, John, like with that MIT woman, if your product works and you can sell it, let's go. I don't think product market fit has much to do with sales. That's a mistake that a lot of people make. Like I think there's a huge ambiguity and misdefinition of what really product market fit is. I just think it's about creating customer value with your product. And this is where it gets right to your question, John, of like, what do we look at uniquely in the ecosystem? And I think both the investors and the founders are prematurely obsessed with top line revenue growth as a measure of whether you have a good business. And I think that's not right, especially early stages. I think it's more about customer value creation. And I think the best quantification of that, at least in my sector of B2B software, is your customer retention number. That's what I look at first. So while most investors are like, how fast are you growing revenue? I'm like, how are you retaining revenue? And we look heavily, this is something we've invented at Stage 2 Capital, of leading indicators of retention. Because oftentimes, the ultimate measure of your customer retention is a lagging indicator. If you say, I have 92% annual customer retention, that's a measure of what you did a year ago. And so we are looking for leading indicators of retention, which are behaviors or events that are occurring with your customer in the first month of their experience with your product, that if they occur, they're going to be with you forever. And if they don't occur, they're probably going to churn. And there's some famously documented examples of that, of like people, like companies like Slack. If the customer sends 2,000 team messages a month, that was their leading indicator of retention. If they did it, they're probably going to be with them forever. If they didn't, they're probably going to churn. If for HubSpot, is like if they used 5 or more features in the 25 feature platform. If they did that, probably going to be there forever. If they didn't, so that's what we help our companies identify for their business as part of our investment diligence process. And that's probably one of the biggest drivers of what we look for uniquely for startups.
I went to Alex Hormozi private event and I went through all of the different exercises and stuff. His main investment guy, after we went through a BTI and all of this stuff, if I look at it, the way you're positioning it, my company's worth zero based on EBITDA. He said, well, you're a startup though, right? And have you raised any money? I said, yeah, my money, I invested. And he goes, well, our valuation process doesn't work for you because your value of your company is based on how much you can sell it for. And then I was sitting around on my porch. Because
he was measuring it by EBITDA?
Yes.
He said? Yeah. I mean, even like public software businesses that are worth tens of billions of dollars are not producing EBITDA. So it's a hard thing to like conceptualize, but when there's a business that, and this is like really well rigorous Ivy League finance, like when you have a business that has an enormous growth opportunity, like, you know, a business that's doing $500 million in revenue, but can grow at 30, 40, 50% a year. Like, you're a growth stock. Any profit you're generating, you should recycle into your business to grow faster and capture the market opportunity. In fact, they could argue that you should spend more money than you're generating because of that. And that's what the market rewards. So that's like a kind of like a
something that the general public has a problem with is like, how could you have a good business if you're not generating?
Yeah. And this is what happened with Amazon.
And that's because they have such a big opportunity. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, it's not, you can't look at it as like accounting profit. It's like the math on like, is what you're charging your customer substantially more than what it costs to sell the product. That's important. Like that has to work. That's not a good business. If you're not charging your customer more than what it costs to sell, like substantially more, like 4 or 5X more, that's a problem. But that's not accounting EBITDA, because it doesn't account for like, how many engineers do you have building new stuff?
Exactly.
Like if you have an opportunity, you should invest heavily in that, sometimes more beyond your cash flow. And so that, you know, it's fine. Like there's like accounting principles to value a company on EBITDA and forward looking cash flow, but it doesn't work in every single type of business opportunity.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Cause I was sitting on my porch the other day and I'm like, you know, there's so many people talking about so many different ways. And to me, your ultimate value is what you said, is what is your value proposition to the customer? Is it worth more to them than the amount of money they have to pay you for it? That's the ultimate value proposition.
You got to get that math to work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. They often call it unit economics. Yeah, for sure.
Now that you're in the venture capital space.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about what you see that's working. What do you think is the biggest mistake some of these companies make as startups?
I mean, if you're interested in this and you're listening, you can Google the top 10 mistakes that SaaS companies make when scaling their business, Mark Roberge. I did a speech on this at Sastr like 3 years ago. So there's a long list, and I'm not trying to be like egotistical. I'm just trying to be helpful of like some of the stuff that I see. I think the biggest one is kind of what I alluded to of like, I'll kind of fill in the blanks. So I talked about that lead indicator attention, but the biggest mistake is scaling revenue too early and too fast. You know, because they're confused on what product market fit is. And they go out, they find 3, 4, 5 customers, beta customers, let's call them. And the product works for them. And they're like, sweet, let's scale. And the venture capitalist gives them 5, 10 million bucks, and they hire 20 salespeople the next month. There's 7 problems in there. You know, it's just like you're scaling too early and you're scaling too fast. So what you have to do is you've got to assess whether you have product market fit and go-to-market fit, and those have to happen in order. And we've kind of flirted around this, John, in our conversation. So the first thing is product market fit. And that's what I said. It's not about how much revenue of customers you have. It's about your customer. In my space of B2B software, it's customer retention. You can translate it to like apparel and other things by like whether people buy more from you, what their MPS is on their product. There's ways to measure customer value in other situations, but I'm just gonna talk about B2B software. So you have to have really good, you know, customer retention and leading indicators of retention. And I don't actually care at that point whether you're generating a profit, John, like we talked about. I don't even care if you're selling the product at a higher price than what it costs for you to sell it. You know, not everyone has the opportunity to do that with capital, but like, it's friggin' hard to come up with an idea, as you know, and to create a product that people like. So that's what we have to do first. And so like, we just want to have like, if we sign up 10 customers a month, we want 9 of them a month from now to be like, this is awesome. Don't ever take it away from me. I don't care if you're selling it for a price more than what it costs you, because like, you don't have a sales team yet. We don't have an operationalized sales team. And I don't really care what the price is. It can't be free because people aren't going to take it seriously, but it doesn't have to be optimized. Then we've got product market fit. When 9 out of 10 are like, this is awesome, I'm retaining forever. Beautiful product market fit. But then we have to do go-to-market fit, to your point, John. And that is, now we have to make this profitable. And that's not EBITDA. This is unit economics. It's like, can you charge a price that's substantially higher than what it costs you to sell it? And if you're listening and if you're new to this stuff, you can Google unit economics. There's a couple very common, well rigorously researched studies, metrics like LTV to CAC, lifetime value to CAC ratios. They like to see that above 3. Payback period, they like to see that below 12 months. There's this thing called the magic number. They like to see that below 1.0. We don't have time to go into all those things, but you can Google them and read about them. And so at that point, now you have to get that to work. And now you're working on your pricing model. You're working on your sales process codification. You're working on your compensation plan. And once you have that going, now you're ready to scale. Okay, so that's the first answer is, when are you ready to scale? Not when some VC tells you, not when you have three customers that like you. It's when you have product market fit and go to market fit. You do those in sequence and you use your data to calculate when you're ready. Now, the next question is how fast? And this is not about like, I have two reps. Now, according to Mark, we have product market info, go to market fit. Now I have to scale. Most people will just go out and hire 20 reps in the next month. Bad. You're not ready for it. Like, you don't have a recruiting muscle to hire 20 good reps in a month. You don't have a marketing muscle to generate enough demand to feed them. And you don't have any managers to coach them. So when you scale, it's not about one big lump sum hiring at the beginning of the year. It's about a pace. It's like, cool, we're ready to scale. Let's hire two reps every other month. Good. And we're going to do that for 6 months and going to watch the leading indicators of retention and watch the leading indicators of unit economics. And if they stay green, we'll go faster. We'll hire two reps a month. We do that for 6 months. Cool. If they stay green, we go faster. Four reps a month, 6 months, right? Then we do eight reps a month for 6 months. Now you're a unicorn. Now you're worth $1 billion. Congrats. So that's the biggest mistake, I think, is like, you know, scaling prematurely and too fast.
What advice would you give, you know, SaaS founders or startups on pricing their SaaS solution?
The professional, like McKinsey answer, like when a big company like GE or Procter & Gamble goes and hires McKinsey to do a price analysis, they'll go out and do a complicated conjoint analysis, which like it'll cost McKinsey, like, it costs the company like $50 million, and you just can't do that, right? So you have to, you know, in entrepreneurship, that's the fun thing is you have to cut some corners and know which corners to cut, right? So you can't do a $50 million research analysis. Hypothetically, your pricing is the intersection of three lenses. The first lens is, how is the customer going to measure ROI of your product? And you could probably charge like a third of that. So like what kind of like ROI, and that's not always easy to do, but like, how is your customer thinking about like whether it's going to increase sales by this much or decrease cost by this much? You could probably charge a third of that on a given year. So that's one lens. The second lens is how much do you have to charge to make money? So like, what's your estimate and like how much it's going to cost you to sell this thing? And you've got to probably generate, like, you have to kind of recoup your cost of sale in about a year. Okay. So, and that's in the B2B software arena. So that's another lens. And the third lens is, how much does it cost for the customer to acquire that value through a substitute product? Could be the competition, could be like any other substitute. Like if you're selling sunscreen, a substitute's an umbrella. You know what I mean? Of course, sunscreen is like, has some value because I can walk around without holding an umbrella. But like, so it's those three lenses, John. And also, if you want to, let me see if I can find this. I always forget the name because it's... Pricing matrix. Yeah, I can't find it. There's this really cool pricing model. It's I'll try to find it. We can come back to the show with the notes, but like you basically ask the customer. You do a survey and ask them, like, at what price does this feel way too expensive? At what price does this feel like expensive, but I'll still buy? At what price does this feel like cheap, but I'll buy? And what price does this feel like too cheap that it can't be good? Something along those lines. And there's this complicated intersection that like allows you to figure it out. So that's like a survey oriented way, but like, you know, those are the three lenses that you can think about to kind of, if you're an entrepreneur, you got to be a little scrappy, and it's embarrassing how we came up with the price of HubSpot. You'd think it'd be a sophisticated thing. It was like us sitting around with beers and coming up with it.
Yeah, well, it worked out quite well. So, you know, what's your approach to, you know, hiring and recruiting, training, and retaining salespeople?
Well, that was the book, you know, and the sales acceleration formula, where, you know, the backstory there was, I was in the final year or two of HubSpot. I was having breakfast with Jill Conrath, who has since retired, but she was one of the best sales authors of our era, wrote a bunch of best-selling books. And after our breakfast, she wrote down on a piece of paper, she kind of was asking how I did the HubSpot sales team. And she's like, "The Art and Science of Sales by Jill Conrath and Mark Roberge." And she's like, "I'd like to write this book with you." And I was like, "I'm not a very good writer, but how can you say no to that opportunity?" You know, and that's what I was talking about earlier, John, when these serendipitous moments just happen, you know, and you got to hop on them. And so she's like, "Great, write a chapter and I'll write a chapter. We'll go to my publisher and we'll pitch them." And I did. And she's like, she read the chapter. She's like, "Oh my gosh, this is awesome." She's like, "You got to write your own book." And that's what it was about, John, was like, at the time I was this, like, you know, MIT guy, like we talked about. I had a career of quant and coding and all that stuff that found himself in the seat of a sales leader. And obviously I'm, you know, when you're under the pressure of like a monthly quota and you're either hit it or you're fired and your young family behind you, someone like myself leans on the quant to drive every decision that you do, from hiring to training to leading the sales team. And I was very lucky that we were at this macroeconomic transition point in the world of sales, where we were going from the pre-internet era where salespeople were like, you know, good-looking people out in the field taking folks golfing and out to steak dinners. Like almost all sales, especially in software, were done face-to-face, big deals. And because of the post-internet era, suddenly, and HubSpot was one of the first companies to do this, we were closing deals on the phone. People were like, "You're closing a deal without meeting a customer?" Today, it's like, big deal. That was profound. So like the whole team was inside in the office. And when you're in the office and you're doing inside sales, you don't have CRM adoption issues much anymore like you did in the field. In the field, they were doing everything in their notebook. No one ever did anything in the CRM. But when you were inside, if you set it up right, they couldn't even figure out who to call without opening up the CRM. So suddenly we had all this data. And now you have this, like, again, the opposite of a perfect storm, the perfect opportunity, where you got this like quant guy with all this data. So I was able to, like, you know, bring a lot of quant to those typically non-quant questions, like, how do you hire a rep? Well, I wanted to document like the 8 attributes that I thought correlated with success. I wanted to document what the definition of each attribute was, like with coachability, what does it mean to be coachable? And I wanted to document what a score of an 8 versus a 4 versus a 1 would sound like. So I created a scorecard. And then after hiring dozens of reps every year, eventually hundreds, you could run a regression analysis correlating your score to success. And you could actually engineer your hiring formula. And same with training. You know, like, you know, with training, you could actually score folks coming through training and have your trainer predict if they're going to do well. Same with coaching. Like the coaching model was just like every month, everyone had a one-on-one with their manager to evaluate their data, see where they were different in the funnel from the rest of the team, diagnose why, and come up with a coaching plan for that month to improve that data. And I could measure the success. I could quantify the success of your coaching. You're going to coach John on developing sense of urgency better with his opportunities. How will we know if you succeeded? Because his opportunity to customer rate is going to go from 17% to 22%. So a lot of it can be boiled back down to math. And that was the book, Sales Acceleration Formula.
Yeah, and it's a great book. And so I just wanted to know if there was any nuances in the recruiting aspect of it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And that wasn't as much quant. It was, I don't remember the gentleman's name that gave me the best advice. And he was like, the key to sales recruiting is to create an agency within your company. What does that mean? Okay. So he's like, here's how that goes. He's like, and no offense to corporate recruiters here. This is just what he said. He's like, typically you can either hire a corporate recruiter to come work for you. And corporate recruiters that work in a big company, they like cushy jobs. So what they're going to do is they're going to set up ads on LinkedIn and Indeed and other places and get a bunch of applications and then share those applications with you. But the problem with sales is every great salesperson never has to create a resume. Every great salesperson has their last three bosses calling them every quarter being like, are you happy? Because I want to tell you about the new company I'm at. Come work for me. So if you're dependent on active candidates, you're dealing with the bottom of the barrel. And that's what corporate recruiters are going to get you. Now you can go to an agency. And agency recruiters get paid a lot because they go and hunt. They go cold call. They go research on LinkedIn and find people. We get those calls all the time, John. The problem with agencies is you are one of 20 clients. So when they find a star, they're going to give the star to whoever's paying them the highest fee. So here's what you have to do. You have to start an agency in your company. So that's what I did, is I went out and found a woman who I got introduced to, and she's like, yeah, you know, I'm at an agency right now. I'm one of the top recruiters. I'm going to go start my agency. And I'm like, cool, do it at HubSpot. She's like, what do you mean? I'm like, start the agency in HubSpot. We're your only client. She's like, well, how does that work? I'm like, how much do you want to make? You're like, how much is success when you're at your agency? She gave me a number. I'm like, great, that's how much you make. You know, and unlike a corporate recruiter where it's like a flat salary, it's like, that's not how it works at your agency. You get half base, half commission. She's like, cool. And I'm like, that's how much your people are going to make too. We're going to put like a number on their head, just like an agency. And we're going to pay them whatever, 50% higher than a typical corporate recruiter, but it's commission based. And cool. She built an agency in HubSpot. And that allowed us to get passive candidates, which you needed. And we were the only client.
You know, when you went to market with HubSpot, you guys did a unique where, you know, you did it with blogs. You didn't want to run ads. You didn't want to do a bunch of different things, you said. But the terrain has startup world is really changed, and SaaS is really.
Yeah, 18 years later.
Yeah, 18 years later. So if you're going to market today, what would you do to generate leads for a new SaaS?
It's circumstantial to your context. And I wrote an article about this last year called Choosing the Right Demand Gen Channel for Your Startup. And I broke down what I mean by context. So I pretty much categorized as like the type of product you're selling. Is it pencils or jets? You know, and who you're selling to. Is it CTOs or is it like chief medical officers? You know, like these are the different contextual things, right? So typically, like if you're selling expensive stuff, you know, 6-7-digit stuff, account-based marketing and account-based selling is what you want to read up on. And this is basically like identifying the like dozens of influencers and decision makers within a single company and constructing a unique message and outreach channel for each one to drive momentum within the organization. Product-led growth is a hot one today that I think we're still in the early 50% of exploiting. And that is like, you know, letting your product lead by being a free product that people can try and then expand them. It's not made for every startup, but like I break down when that's applicable. You basically need a low time and effort to value scenario. Like click a button and it works. Dropbox, click a button, your PC is backed up. Beautiful. Product-led growth. HubSpot CRM, boom. Click a button, you're making calls, you know? So it depends. I don't know if there's like, I guess like, you know, we are on the verge of like, these demand gen things go in waves. There's a little bit of a gifting movement. We're an investor in Sendoso, full transparency. And like, in certain situations, it's worth it to give a little gift to get someone's attention. And there, some companies have codified that so you can do it effectively and measure ROI and distribute that revenue across your team. I don't know if there's like a standout one, like at the moment of inbound marketing. I think the big thing right now is AI and whether anything we're working on right now is relevant as we move into this post AI world. Sorry for like tangenting from your question, but that's the thing that I've been thinking about. And I suppose like that may lead to an answer to your question, which is to exploit AI to change the economics on typical demand gen channels, because there's a lot of opportunities to do that right now.
Yeah. And I saw on your LinkedIn, and I saw a couple posts that you've actually started creating or working with AI. Tell us more about that and how you're using it.
I think we're in a hype cycle right now, as many people. I think we're in like, if you can draw a parallel to the internet, I think we're in like 1998. Remember in the internet in 1998, we dialed up through AOL. We opened up a Netscape browser and we did a search in Alta Vista. You know, the first movers rarely win. I think that's where we are right now. I think we don't know what the technology is. In 1997, we thought the internet was putting your company brochure online. We couldn't conceptualize Snowflake and Twilio and all those things. I think that's where we are right now. I think the big winners in AI are seed stage right now, if not even having started. And so you have to be careful. And what's really going to come is right now, the AI companies today are just streamlining the existing workflow. And that's the hype companies that are going to go under. The real winners in AI are going to recreate the workflow. In our world, John, it's not about like, how do you get a cold caller to like find people to cold call and devise messages faster? That's hype. 1.0 goes away. The post AI world is buyer bots buying from seller bots, no humans. It's like no longer operations is supporting people. It's people are supporting the algorithm.
A lot of people ask, do you think that AI will replace sales? What's your answer?
I mean, dude, my car just drove itself 4 hours without, I didn't even move the wheel. Like, and we're teaching 25-year-olds to do discovery. Like AI has already read 2,000 sales books in 30 seconds. So yeah, I think it will. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just being a realist. And we can have another podcast about what that does to society and everything. Because I thought a lot about it, but I don't see how it doesn't.
Eventually, once other people, you know it, like it, trust it more and more, especially for FMCG goods and low ticket items. People don't even need salespeople to do that right now.
Yeah, they'll be pressured on it. I mean, the first wave of the internet, every CTO was like, I'll never put my data in the cloud. And the early movers did. It was secure. And they saved a lot of money. And the laggards had to stay in business. And so I don't know if it's as much a matter of like people will like it. It's just that they'll be, some people will move first. They'll save a ton of money and the rest will have to follow.
Your company, Stage 2 Capital, is actually about building and scaling sales forces for startups and as a investor group, right?
Yeah. So we look for B2B software companies, any type, not AI, because we think it's a hype cycle. So we're a little cautious there and just help them build their first sales org. Yep. Anyone around approaching $1 million in revenue.
I'm not just impressed, you know, I'm involved because for me, like I will go back and listen to this podcast myself. There's so many gems that you put out there because, you know, I definitely have to use AI because I have a CRM within my system. I get put in that box and that's a road to the bottom. And how do you take on a 500-pound gorilla?
Now you can. Because the game's changing and it's harder for the big incumbents to embrace it than the attackers. So it's a big opportunity.
Yeah, it's either that or find a bigger freaking gorilla.
Just remember in 1995, there were two CRMs that owned all the market, Siebel and Act.
Now it's Salesforce, HubSpot, and Zoho.
Right. So where is it going to be in 15 years?
It's going to be the sales machine.
That's a great ending, John.
And let's just keep in touch, Mark.
Thanks so much. Good luck with everything. Talk to you soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to send a review about what you liked on this podcast or share it with somebody who would need it to definitely improve their business building and scaling sales teams, do me a favor, like, share. It means a lot to me so that we can help others grow and live in abundance. That's a wrap, folks. Thanks for joining me today. And if you got value from this episode, do me a favor, like, subscribe, and refer a friend. And if you want even more value, go to thesalesmachine.com, click on resources, and there's tons of resources there to increase profits and drive performance in your business. Right on, right on. Come on.